Hellcat.
Hello, nobody. This is Matthew McGebna. You're listening to the Ink Drop. Solo show today. This week, I should say. I don't have a guest with me. So it's just me kind of spitballing, thinking about some of the things that I've been thinking about this week. A little bit of good news, a little bit of exciting news. My podcast, The Ink Drop, now is up on Apple Podcasts and it's on Spotify. So you can listen to my podcast from any of those places. Obviously, I also link it to my website. And I usually tweet it out, put it out on Facebook. But that's very exciting now. If you have the Apple Podcast app on your phone, you can just find it, search up The Ink Drop. Please subscribe, leave a review or a rating. That would help me a lot. More ratings, it's kind of like Amazon with books. The more ratings you give, the more it bumps you up. So ratings, reviews, all that stuff's available. I think on both, definitely on Apple Podcasts, possibly even Spotify. But those two places will be housing my podcast or hosting my podcast for the time being. So that's exciting. That's some exciting news I wanted to share. What was I thinking about this week? What is writer's block? The idea of writer's block. If you're in an MFA program or any writing program, hold on a second, any writing program even at the bachelor's level, it will not take long for you to encounter a professional writer or a visiting professor who tells you that writer's block doesn't exist. For me, it was my third year in college when I had transferred to a college that had a more intensive writing program. My first 2 years of college, I was at a community college, which was more of a liberal arts. But once I transferred and got into a much more writing intensive program, within my first semester, I heard this. It was my spring semester. My spring semester professor said this: writer's block doesn't exist because it's not a physiological thing. He would say, you know, is something physically blocking you from the keyboard or preventing you from picking up a pen? Then it doesn't exist. So you get the point pretty quickly that writer's block is not something you can fall back on or discuss with professors. And in a way, it was a good thing, right? Because it prevented you from blowing off assignments or not taking your workshop seriously. I never bought into it all that much either. I was kind of on their side about it because for me, I always had a discipline about me when it came to writing that I never really had block, right? Plus, I used to switch genres all the time. So if I wasn't feeling the fiction I was working on, I would try to sit down and write a poem. If the poem wasn't coming out of me, I would jot down a scene of dialogue for a possible use in a play. I went into the MFA program at Southampton College at 23 thinking that I was going to write the great American novel, and I came out of the MFA program with a full-length play as my thesis. So I traveled back and forth between genres, and I think that kept me out of writer's block at a young age. So when professors started in about writer's block not existing, I was fine with it. I was like, okay, yeah, it probably doesn't, because I never really experienced it. As I got on in years, you know, I think I finally encountered what people would classically define as writer's block, but I wouldn't necessarily call it a block. I would refer to it more as interference. In football, I like to use a football analogy. Pass interference is when a defender does something that unfairly interferes with another player's ability to catch the ball. And when I say unfairly, I mean unfairly because interference for writers comes from a lot of unfair places, mostly in our heads. There are a number of ways that interference manifests itself in the life of a writer. You know, and if you're a writer and you're listening to this, you probably can understand where I'm going with this. We make a mistake when we call it writer's block because very little of these causes have anything to do with writing, right? The act of actually putting something down on paper or constructing a story, or developing a poem. It's not writer's block, it's interference. Interference happens on or appears on the landscape, comes riding over that hill in the distance, black horses, in a lot of ways. One way is resentment. Yeah, resentment. No matter where you are in your career, resentment has a way of really, really running interference against your artistic aspirations. If you're a published writer, like I am, the resentment comes in the form of, why didn't the critics pay more attention to the book? Why did the critics pan the book? I'll never forget when Kirkus came out with its review of Little Beasts. I was working at a PR agency on the second floor of a commercial building, and I wanted to climb out on the ledge. And then the Publishers Weekly review came out, and I wanted to jump. I talk about the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. When the Publishers Weekly review came out, actually, I was, believe it or not, I was standing on a stage pitching Little Beasts to a room packed with bloggers and reviewers at the Book America Expo in New York at the Javits Center. And I got home and I was like, I was just on cloud nine. I was walking on clouds. I was jazzed. It was amazing. My wife was like, did it go well? I'm like, yes. She says, did you see there was a write-up about your book? I said, I heard. Yes. Was it good? She goes, no. Picture the Hindenburg, crashing to the ground in flames. That was basically the image of my emotional state at the time. All this work, all this emotional work, the self-doubt, all the support and the praise I got from my editor and my publisher and the reviewers, the trade reviewers, they didn't see any of that. They don't see any of that behind-the-scenes stuff, all that work and labor that you put in. Right? So what happens, this is what can happen, is the published writer then starts looking around at what other published writers are having said about them by Kirkus and Publishers Weekly and general publications and blogs. And it can make you bitter and resentful. Yeah, absolutely. But that resentment is just, it's interference. It takes you away from your work. It's just interference. Right? With unpublished writers, the resentment can be a little more obvious. Right? There are probably unpublished writers right now resentful of me, right? Because I'm published and I got some press for the book was good, right? And not all the press was bad. I got a lot of good reviews from blogs, and Newsday did a half-page story about me, and the Amazon reviews, the customer reviews of my book are all pretty good. But that resentment the unpublished writer has for the published writer is interference all the same. It's the same animal, the interference, whether you're published or you're not. Unpublished writer, though, it just looks a little bit different, right? You start to develop conspiracies about why you're not published, and then the next thing you know, you start giving up on writing every day, right? Because you're chasing the success and not the art. And that happens, I think, to every writer of every stripe. I bet if you ask Colson Whitehead right now if he ever felt resentful of another writer, he'd tell you yes. And he was on the cover of Time magazine, for God's sake. So resentment is absolutely a form of interference, and it can absolutely get you away from your computer. You just sort of give, you throw your hands up. Right? Getting into fights. Second one, right? Second bit of interference. This is an easy one to think about avoiding, but getting into fights is absolutely a form of interference. I don't mean Twitter. I don't mean street fights. Right, I'm talking about these online fights we get into a lot of times as writers. Sometimes it's so much easier to get into fights on Twitter, right, and pick on people through Facebook than it is to, actually sit down and create something of your own. Right? It's even better if you can combine your resentment with your internet fights. If I can just grab my resentment, pull it down, roll it up in a ball with my internet fights, if you can focus on another writer more successful than you, And then call him or her out for something they said and get everyone whipped up over it. Hell, that's a week's worth of not having to write that chapter you've been cooking up in your brain, right? Or that poem you've been trying to construct. I wonder sometimes how much of these Twitter takedowns and cancellations and call-outs aren't just the manifestation of interference. People just trying to avoid their work. Because think of the incentives, right? I mean, if you can start a fight where you're in some sort of moral high ground and you're going to get some attaboys from people who for going after someone who said something or wrote something quote-unquote offensive then that's all the better. Right? And if that person has a poem published in a respectable magazine or wins an award, it's even better because it satisfies your resentment, right? Because it takes down someone who you perceive as having a better time of it than you, right? And B, it consumes you, but not in a way that you feel, in a way that you almost feel is productive, right? It occupies your energy trying to keep your eye on the fight. You know, that's the problem. Think about that next time you think about, getting into one of these things, right? It occupies your energy and your time, right? And just takes up residency in your brain trying to keep this fight going. And meanwhile, your novel is still just sitting there. And it's unwritten, or that chapter you're working on revising, or whatever it may be. Right? I watched something like this materialize in real time once. It was a middle-aged man, unpublished writer, from what I gathered from his Twitter feed, and he was in despair. You know, which is by the way another type of interference to fall into despair. Despair, absolutely. And he said something on Twitter to the effect of, like, anyone else out there feel like you're just shouting into the void, that you submit and the acceptance letters are just not coming in for you? Anyone else feel it's kind of pointless and just want to quit? And a woman writer, I believe, a woman read that tweet and saw fit to tweet back at him, "Suck it up, rejection's part of the game, no one, she had to repeat the no one, wants to hear from some entitled white man right now." You know, she picked a fight, and then she got dragged in the replies, and she spent I don't know how many hours of her day defending herself and getting abused online, and then retreating from the fight into this victim position where, you know, she tweeted out how she was being victimized by misogynists who were making her point for her. And then that caught her more flack from people who were trying to pull her off of the victim ropes that she had clung to, hoping to wait out the bell. You know, it was at least a whole day of this woman carrying on this fight. And I wasn't much better because my interference was in watching this thing unfold, right? I was popping the popcorn. You know, when you think about it, in these fights, the real victim is your own work, right? Which is a nice segue to my next manifestation of interference, which is that your condition as a victim can be interference, right? In a lot of different ways. Most of us have stories about how we've been wronged in some way. Some stories are more crushing and difficult to survive than others. That's just the way it is. But it's in whatever the case may be, it's part of what made us want to become artists in the first place. We often write from that place. Sometimes we even use that pain to fuel the kinds of messages we want to convey to the world. And that happens with everybody, you know, regardless of whatever the grade or the degree, right, of victimization. When I wrote Little Beasts, no question I wanted to write about poverty and growing up with alcoholism and the destructive nature of resentment and poverty. I wanted to write about a community that can be gripped with that other shoe disease, where they're just waiting for that other shoe to drop and just bring the whole house of cards down that they might have just started building for themselves. You know, that reality came from a place of personal pain, right? Observing this taking place in my home and in my hometown, watching people with no political power, no economic power, fall into despair and then only get satisfaction from these brief moments where the feeling of vengeance that they get when they see the downfall of others play out in front of them, as they fall back and become consumed by their own resentment because at least it's some sort of power. They feel it's some sort of karmic energy flowing through the universe. You know, it could be very difficult in these circumstances to keep your victimhood from creating interference, right? And what do I mean by that? Meaning... you can focus so entirely on the way the world is being or has been unfair to you that you conveniently forget about the art you're trying to create, right? And the other way to go with it is that sometimes you may think that the pain that you might have suffered in your life isn't enough, right, compared to what the pain someone else might be feeling. And so there are a number of ways in which your victim status or whatever you might be thinking of yourself, ways in which you were treated unfairly or the world treated you unfairly, can really run interference against what you're trying to create. Yeah. Trend gazing is another type of interference, and that's almost kind of loosely related to what I'm talking about. Nobody has a monopoly on pain and suffering. Jim Morrison once said, no one here gets out alive, right? But it can feel sometimes like there are subjects and conditions that are being covered in literature that you're not entitled to write about or that you don't share. Right, so the interference comes when you wait around until it's quote-unquote your turn to tell the story you want to tell. When you spend too much time gazing at the New York Times bestseller list, or you rummage too much through book pages or Publishers Weekly, you can easily get caught up in denigrating your own projects, in denigrating your own art, because you're matching it up against these trends. It's like, well, I'm writing a poem about the time I lost my lunch money on the way to school, but this guy's writing about the time his whole family was wiped out in a bus crash. I can't write this poem and show my face with it. Right? That's interference messing with you, right? It's not writer's block. It's a place much darker and internal than that. And some of it is what makes you maybe even a good moral person, but it's interference. Interference or writer's block or whatever you want to call it can be defeated, but it's a daily battle if anything I mentioned above is true, right? If you've got any of these things or all of these things going on at the same time, if you've got resentment and you've become consumed by it, if you have become addicted to social media and want to get into these Twitter fights, if you feel that your story isn't good enough to tell, or if you feel that your story, your experiences are hindering you in some way from being able to tell the story. All of those things could be happening sort of at the same time. It's a daily struggle where you have to fight through this interference. There are days where you will wake up, roll up your sleeves, and immediately get yourself tangled up in this stuff that I'm talking about. Right? I'm guilty of all this. Except for the Twitter shaming stuff. I've never reported anyone or called anyone out. I tagged anybody's job in a tweet or anything like that. I'm just not a language cop or a snitch. I don't like snitches. So I steer clear of that stuff. I don't snitch on people's bosses. I don't tag people into their universities. I steer clear of all that stuff. But resentment? Hell yeah. Watching fights on social media? Sign me up. Right, letting literary trends laugh in my concerns, the things that I want to write about or I'm interested in thinking about, absolutely. Right, that happens all the time. Oh my God, look at these books. Look at the subject matter that these are catching. You know, my subject matter doesn't count. Right, you get into that all the time. You look at what's being covered, what books are being celebrated, and you just go, well, my book isn't really anything like these books. You know, you're watching trends. Right, so it's a daily battle, I think, to fight through interference and get to work, whatever work looks like. And that's another type of interference. Believing that in order for a day's work to count, you need to actually pen 1,000 words or 500 words. Sometimes taking a walk is working. Many people who are not writers don't understand this, by the way. And you are going to encounter people in your life who are not writers who will say, like, what are you doing that? Get to work. You should be at the computer, right? Or, oh, he says he's a writer, but I see him walking through the park all the time, right? Sometimes taking a walk is working. Sometimes storyboarding an idea is working. Sometimes it's revising something you've already written, or character sketching some of your minor characters to get a clear picture of how they might interact. That's all work. But interference, and interference from others, will convince you that it's not work. It's not work, it's not art, unless it culminates in a polished piece that you will win a pushcart nomination for. That's interference getting into your head. And that's actually one of the few places where it may not just come from you. It can come from other people. Well, you say you wanted 2 hours to work, and all I see you is banging a tennis ball against the wall. Well, that is work. Right? Because if you're working something out in your head, that is work. That's not to say that there does need to be a time when you actually do sit down and put your fingers down on the keyboard. But there are a lot of ways in which writers are working when they're always working. right? There were you could be working at the restaurant while you're sitting around with your family, right? You could be working on a date while you're on a date. I want to share some ideas that were put forth by Stephen Pressfield. I don't know if you know Stephen Pressfield. He wrote, his most famous work, I think, would be The Legend of Bagger Vance, because it became a film with Will Smith. Stephen Pressfield has this book out called The War of Art. It's an amazing book. I really highly recommend that you purchase a copy, keep it on your shelves, refer to it. It could be one of these things that you just keep handy to just give yourself a kick in the pants, because that's exactly what it is. It's called The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. Stephen with a V, S-T-E-V-E-N. I'll link maybe his book on Amazon in the show notes if you're interested in taking a look at this. The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield, amazing, amazing book. He calls interference in the book, he calls it resistance. But there's a lot of overlap with what I'm talking about here. One of the things he talks about is being a professional as opposed to being an amateur. And if this isn't a kick in the nuts, I don't know what is. Right, check this out. He said on page, this is on page 64, he talks about a professional. He says, someone asked Somerset Maugham if he wrote on a schedule or only when struck by inspiration. Quote, I write only when inspiration strikes, he replied. Fortunately, it strikes every morning at 9 o'clock sharp. That's a pro. In terms of resistance, Maugham was saying, I despise resistance. I will not let it faze me. I will sit down and do my work. Maugham reckoned another deeper truth, that by performing the mundane physical act of sitting down and starting to work, he set in motion a mysterious but infallible sequence of events that would produce inspiration, as surely as if the goddess had synchronized her watch with his. He knew if he built it, she would come. He talks quite a bit about the muse and the goddesses of muse. But, yeah, that's a really interesting thing about, like, that's what a pro does. A pro shows up. A pro comes to sit down. There's a little bit more of this a little bit later. Let me share this with you. Talking about being a pro and what makes you a pro. Well, you're part of this. You're listening to this podcast. You're a writer. Then maybe you are a pro already, right? And all of us are pros on some level if we have a job, right? All of us are pros in one area, he says, our jobs. We get a paycheck, we work for money, we are professionals. Now, are there principles we can take from what we're already successfully doing in our workaday life and apply to our artistic aspirations? What exactly are the qualities that define us as professionals? Number one, we show up every day. We might do it only because we have to keep from getting fired, but we do it. We show up every day. Two, we show up no matter what. In sickness and in health, come hell or high water, we stagger into the factory. We might do it only so as not to let down our coworkers or for other less noble reasons, but we do it. We show up no matter what. Three, we stay on the job all day. Our minds may wander, but our bodies remain at the wheel. We pick up the phone when it rings. We assist the customer when he seeks our help. We don't go home till the whistle blows. Four, we are committed over the long haul. Next year, we may go to another job, another company, another country, but we'll still be working. Until we hit the lottery, we are part of the labor force. Five, the stakes for us are high and real. This is about survival, feeding our families, educating our children. It's about eating. Six, we accept remuneration for our labor. We're not here for fun. We work for money. Seven, we do not over-identify with our jobs. We may take pride in our work. We may stay late and come in on weekends, but we recognize that we are not our job descriptions. The amateur, on the other hand, over-identifies with his avocation, his artistic aspiration. He defines himself by it. He's a musician, a painter, a playwright. Resistance loves this. Resistance knows that the amateur composer will never write his symphony because he's overly invested in its success and over-terrified of its failure. The amateur takes it so seriously it paralyzes him. Eight, we master the technique of our jobs. Nine, we have a sense of humor about our jobs. 10, we receive praise or blame in the real world. Now consider the amateur. Oof, this is tough reading. Consider the amateur, the aspiring painter, the wannabe playwright. How does he pursue his calling? 1, he doesn't show up every day. 2, he doesn't show up no matter what. 3, he doesn't stay on the job all day. He's not committed over the long haul. The stakes for him are illusory and fake. He does not get money, and he over-identifies with his art. He does not have a sense of humor about failure. You don't hear him bitching, "This fucking trilogy is killing me." Instead, he doesn't write his trilogy at all. The amateur has not mastered the technique of his art, nor does he expose himself to judgment in the real world. If we show our poem to our friend and our friend says, "It's wonderful, I love it," that's not real-world feedback. That's a friend being nice to us. Nothing is as empowering as real-world validation, even if it's for failure. The first professional writing job I ever had, after 17 years of trying, was on a movie called King Kong Lives. I and my partner at the time, Ron Shusett, a brilliant writer and producer who also did Alien and Total Recall, hammered out the screenplay for Dino De Laurentiis. We loved it. We were sure we had a hit. Even after we'd seen the finished film, we were certain it was a blockbuster. We invited everyone we knew to the premiere, even rented out the joint next door for a post-Triumph blowout. "Get there early," we warned our friends. "The place will be mobbed." Nobody showed. There was only one guy in line beside our guests, and he was muttering something about spare change. In the theater, our friends endured the movie in mute stupefaction. When the lights came up, they fled like cockroaches into the night. Next day came the review in Variety. Quote, "Ronald Shusett and Stephen Pressfield, we hope these are not their real names for their parents' sake." End quote. When the first week's grosses came in, the flick barely registered. Still, I clung to hope. Maybe it's only tanking in urban areas. Maybe it's playing better in the burbs. I motored to an Edge City multiplex. A youth manned the popcorn booth. "How's King Kong Lives?" I asked. He flashed thumbs down. "Miss it, man. It sucks." I was crushed. Here I was, 42 years old, divorced, childless, having given up all normal human pursuits to chase the dream of being a writer. Now I finally got my name on a big-time Hollywood production starring Linda Hamilton, and what happens? I'm a loser, a phony, my life is worthless, and so am I. My friend, Tony Kebbelman, snapped me out of it by asking if I was going to quit. "Hell no. Then be happy. You're where you wanted to be, aren't you? So you're taking a few blows. That's the price for being in the arena and not on the sidelines. Stop complaining and be grateful." That was when I realized I had become a pro. I had not yet had success, but I had a real failure. When I read that whole list about what amateurs do, I felt like such a fraud. I felt like such an imposter.
"Where did you learn your trade, you stupid fucking cunt, you idiot?"
Yes, exactly. Well, one of the good things, though, about interference is that, or learning your trade, is that you can reboot and restart today. If you've ever been a professional, you can be one again. I can be one again. I take heart in that a lot of times. Here are some ways that I'm thinking about. How do you get out of writer's block? How do you get away from interference? How do you work your way through this? How do you fight through this thing that you might call writer's block? It sounds like a romantic thing to call it. I just call it interference. Here are some things that I think would help, because they have helped me in the past and they'll probably help me in the future. Number one, start by thinking about multiple ways to create. As I said when I started this episode, when I was 23, I didn't have a problem with writer's block, partly because I kept jumping between different genres. For me, at that time, it was about creation, creating raw, unadulterated creation of something that wasn't there, and then it was. To call something out of nothing and into being is such a powerful thing. Remember that feeling. Remember that impulse. If I think back and remember that time period, I wasn't thinking about publishing. I wasn't thinking about trends, right? I wasn't reading reviews and watching other writers get recognition. I had made up my mind, maybe a little foolishly, to be honest, when I think about it, but I had made up my mind that I hadn't really developed my voice, and so I wasn't in the publishing game. I wasn't in that part of the game, right? But I was in the creation game, and honestly, it's the best way to fight through interference. Focus on creation. And if one type of creating is getting in your way, direct your energy to create something else. You never know where it's going to take you, how it might even double back to, you know, inform the piece of writing that you're stuck on. Robert Frost says, way leads on to way, right? Follow your energy down whatever path it's taking, but show up. Show up and do the work. Number two, get out of the resentment game. Get out of it. Creation helps you get out of that, but sometimes it's also about changing your mindset. I don't want to get too spiritual here, but if it helps, think about other writers in this world as an appendage of the artwork amoeba you are a part of. When one part moves, everybody moves. Allow yourself to be happy for other people. Congratulate a writer on Twitter if he or she wins a major award. Even if you don't care for their work. Especially if you don't care for their work. Especially if they were an asshole to you at the last reading you attended. In fact, that's a homework assignment. Your homework for tonight is think of a writer you can't stand and pretend you're congratulating them on winning the Nobel Prize. Do that thought experiment. I want you to close your eyes if you're not driving and imagine a blanket. It was my visualization. Imagine a blanket, a large blanket. It could be any color you want. My blanket is blue. I guess that's my favorite color. My blanket is blue. But imagine a blanket, a large blanket the size of a country. And try to imagine that we're all moving in a directionless direction, if that makes sense. And when I say we're all, I mean us writers, we noble few, we brave few writers. Right? We're all underneath the blanket, moving around. Picture imagine this under the blanket. Some of us are getting up a real head of steam and pulling the blanket along, and some of us are just trying to keep under it. But the point of view from above the blanket now, imagine being above the blanket, a bird flying over the blanket. The bird's eye view is of one large, multicolored blanket moving through the universe. No individual for the time being, no individuals, just a collective fabric woven together by the labor of creating art. If you can see that blanket, you can see a way out of resentment. You will begin to appreciate the things you've accomplished, the things you've created, regardless of whether or not Publishers Weekly jerked off to it. This reminds me of my Russian therapist that I had back when I was in Queens. I was in my mid-30s. I was living in like the Forest Hills area of Queens. And I made an appointment. At the time, I was in my early to mid-30s. I was just wallowing in resentment. I mean, just wallowing in self-doubt and disappointment that I hadn't broken through at that point in the literary world. I was just an absolute mess. So I made an appointment to see this therapist. And he was turned out to be a middle-aged Russian man. And I just poured it all out. I went for it. I gave him everything. The resentment, the failure that is my life, everything that was just causing me sadness and depression and everything. And he was like, at the end of this rant, this tirade of everything that was bothering me, the kitchen sink, he says, do you have a job? I was like, yeah, I have a job. Can you pay rent? Do you have food? Does your wife fuck other men? It's like, no. Well, then what are you complaining about? Here, take these pills. Get fuck out of here. All right, so he wasn't the best therapist, but his point was valid. There are writers under this blanket doing far worse than you. What keeps you under the blanket is that you show up and you create art. And that's a pretty special place to be. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. Number three, tell your story as if it's the most important story to ever be told. Trick yourself if you have to. Tell yourself there is no such thing as worse, only different. There are people with different stories to tell, and this is yours. Recognize that feeling like an imposter because you grew up privileged or you didn't suffer from spousal abuse or, right? It's just interference messing with you, man. And to be honest, the real imposters, if you want to think about it, are the amateurs who think that just suffering trauma qualifies them to produce astounding works of literature. Don't worry if you don't have enough trauma, because trauma isn't enough anyway. The business of art is funny business. It will have you tied to whatever their perception of you persists. So if the business thinks you're the cat's pajamas, you're the cat's pajamas. But if the business thinks you're a nobody, you're a nobody. Tying your position under the blanket to your art is interference. Don't let it be. Tell your story. Tell it with honesty and don't fucking flinch. And people will pick up what you're putting down. Hopefully, maybe. Probably not. Probably. Finally, trust that what you put down on paper is a way leading on to way. You're paying your dues in some fashion. You know, the Bible has a lesson called the widow's mite. I don't know if you know the widow's mite. The widow's mite is a story, about the greater value of a poor widow who drops two small coins, or drachma, I believe, as a contribution to the treasury. She does this, you know, she drops these two coins in after all the rich men and women have already dumped their thousands of coins, and Jesus calls over his disciples and says, that woman has contributed more than any of these people because she contributed the sum of her whole livelihood. Creating is your livelihood if you're under this blanket. And what you contribute to this every day has value, and it leads to greater value. A paragraph, a line, a well-thought-out phrase, a productive walk through the woods, it's your contribution of that day. And it's you slaying the dragon of interference. So go henceforth. That's all I have to say. That's my time. Thank you for listening to The Ink Drop. Next week, I'll try to get a guest on here. Get somebody on who can talk to me. I don't know what the subject's going to be yet, but you'll find out. Until then, I hope you enjoy this episode. That's all we have time for. I'll talk to you all next week. Bye, sweeties.